Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Amit Oza, and to help illustrate how recent research advances in the field are affecting clinical practice, Dr. Oza presented patients from his practice, beginning with a 64-year-old woman.
So this was a patient who I treated for quite some time, and she was quite a remarkable lady, very active, very dynamic. And she'd presented with a fairly long story with involvement with cancer. She'd, in the mid-90s or so, she developed bilateral breast cancer, and she was treated for that. She, in fact, underwent bilateral mastectomies, and the disease was receptor positive, so she underwent adjuvant tamoxifen and seemed to have done very well from that. She subsequently had BRCA testing. In fact, at the time that she was diagnosed, I think that BRCA testing wasn't done in the sort of mid-90s, but when her ovarian cancer was subsequently diagnosed, that's when she was BRCA tested, and she was BRCA positive.
This was BRCA 1?
She was BRCA 1 positive.
So I guess 2003, then she developed ovarian cancer.
That's right. In 2003, she developed ovarian cancer, and she presented with increasing abdominal distension. And because of her prior history of breast cancer, there was a sort of high index of suspicion. She underwent investigations and quickly went on to have a total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salping oophorectomy and an omentectomy. And she, in fact, had optimally debulked disease, and she was subsequently treated with adjuvant chemotherapy and seemed to do fairly well for a couple of years. And then about 2005, she had recurrent disease. She had a sort of fairly widespread recurrent disease abdominally, and she was treated again with the same chemotherapy combination, paclitaxel and carboplatin, and again did quite well from that initially, seeming to respond. But unfortunately, within a relatively short period of time, her disease did recur, and this was around the 2006 mark. And in fact, she had a sort of interesting pattern of disease in that she had peritoneal metastatic disease, but she also had multiple lung metastases as well. And this caused a little bit of a diagnostic conundrum initially because of her prior history of breast cancer and whether this could have been breast cancer. She, in fact, had one of the lung nodules biopsied, and it was confirmed to be a sort of high-grade serous recurrence of her ovarian cancer, unusual pattern.
What was going on with her CA-125 at that point?
So her CA-125, in fact, had started to go up. It, in fact, when she had the platinum-resistant recurrence, the CA-125 started climbing up. It was never excessively high. It was in the sort of mid to 300 mark. But she had a lot more disease than CA-125 marker would have indicated. And so at this time, she was still being treated by one of the gyne-oncologists, and she started treatment with liposomal doxorubicin. And she underwent 3 cycles of therapy, but there was no real improvement in her disease. And in fact, some of the lung metastases continued to increase. And so she was referred to me for clinical trial participation. And at the time, we were participating in one of the very early phase 2 clinical trials of bevacizumab, which we were giving in conjunction with metronomic low-dose cyclophosphamide, a daily dose of 50 milligrams continuously. And we were giving the bevacizumab on a 2-weekly basis. We were giving it at 10 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks. And what was remarkable was that within a 8-week period, she had quite a dramatic response to the therapy already being evident. She had, you know, significant regression of most of her sort of index lesions. And in her chest x-ray, I still recall this really vividly several years later, there was central cavitation that seemed to be apparent on the CT scans. It looked as if the tumors were in fact necrosing from the inside. And so we continued with the bevacizumab and the cyclophosphamide, and she went on to have virtually a complete response to therapy. Her CA-125 normalized, the CT scans normalized, the peritoneal disease disappeared. So she had quite a remarkable response to therapy, which was then very well sustained for about 18 months or so. She continued to have the low-dose cyclophosphamide and the bevacizumab as part of the clinical trial. But unfortunately, about 18 months later, she fell over and broke her arm. And that's what necessitated stopping her treatment at the time because of the concerns related to wound healing and bevacizumab.
Did she have to have open surgery for this or just?
No, she didn't actually have open surgery. But when we spoke to the orthopedic surgeons, they were concerned because it was a fairly major fracture. They thought that even though they cast it, we were concerned that the bevacizumab and cyclophosphamide could delay her healing. So she, in fact, stopped therapy and came off treatment, and the bevacizumab cyclophosphamide combination was discontinued. And she remained well for another 6 or 8 months without any evidence of disease recurrence, without any treatment after her arm healed up. And in fact, she had excellent quality of life. So she did all of the things that she wanted to do. But a year or so later, unfortunately, her disease recurred very aggressively.
Same locations?
Same locations, but also new complications as well. She developed bowel obstruction very quickly upon recurrence.
Just to backtrack, when she was on the cyclophosphamide and bevacizumab, did she have any side effects, and particularly any bevacizumab issues, hypertension, nosebleeds?
No, she actually tolerated it very well, and she didn't have any of the sort of classical side effects that we commonly associate with bevacizumab, like hypertension or mucocutaneous bleeding and stuff. She actually was somebody who was tolerating it very well. I think the cycle that we were giving was a 2-weekly cycle of intravenous bevacizumab, and she found that somewhat intrusive in terms of her lifestyle. She didn't like coming back every couple of weeks because she was a very active person. She was also an artist, and so she really enjoyed her quality of life. But in terms of her tolerance, it was actually quite good. But the concern when she had recurrent disease later on was that she actually developed bowel obstruction. And that's where we had a bit of a challenge. We sort of discussed whether potentially outside of a study setting, we could consider rechallenging her with bevacizumab. But with bowel obstruction and the concerns related to potential perforation with bevacizumab, we decided not to use bevacizumab again.
The bowel obstruction was thought to be related to tumor?
Yes, it was disease-related for sure. But it was sort of in multiple different sites. And because of that, there was no surgical possibility to sort of relieve the bowel obstruction.
Sounds like a really tough situation. What did you do?
So we tried giving her gemcitabine chemotherapy, but unfortunately, she didn't respond. She had pretty resistant, chemo-resistant disease, and she deteriorated over a period of about 6 or 8 weeks, and unfortunately, she passed away. It was very sad.
I thought you were going to tell me she went on a trial of a PARP inhibitor and did great.
I would have liked to do that. That was unfortunately sort of just before PARP inhibitors were coming in. That would have been something that would have been really great to try.
And we'll talk about that as we go through this interview. I guess one issue about this case, I ask this, you know, all the time, all the different cancers where bevacizumab is utilized. Any guesses or speculations about why you saw such a great response in this situation? Any tissue predictors that you think someday out there we'll be able to identify a patient like this?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've sort of been scratching our heads in terms of how we can use some sort of biologic or even clinical predictors in terms of efficacy of bevacizumab, and so far haven't come up with anything. There's been a fair amount of work done looking at tumor tissue and to try and put it in context of activity. And so far, nothing really has come out as being a strong predictor. I mean, ovarian cancer is a classic disease which is very VEGF dependent. And because of that, most of the anti-VEGF agents that have been used in ovarian cancer have had a reasonable degree of activity as a single agent, which is unlike other diseases. Bevacizumab, I think, was the first one and comes through with the most robust activity and tolerance profile. But several other anti-angiogenics and anti-VEGF agents have also shown really quite striking activity. And, you know, there's some really interesting things that we see in the clinical setting. I mean, patients who have a lot of effusions and ascites get benefit from their effusions and ascites drying up much earlier than any objective response characteristics. And this certainly seems to suggest that excessive VEGF production is part of ovarian cancer and is causing capillary leakiness, which we can correct very quickly with giving an anti-VEGF agent.
Although this woman, it sounds like ascites wasn't that big of a problem.
No, in this particular patient, ascites was never a problem. She had a slightly unusual pattern of disease where she had some peritoneal disease initially, but lung predominant metastasis, which is very unusual for ovarian cancer. And that's why we had a bit of a diagnostic conundrum as to whether this could have been, you know, related to her breast cancer. It turned out not to be, but we were sort of initially mindful of that differential.
You know, as you were presenting your case, I was thinking how things change. I mean, even over the last 5 or 6 years, mm-hmm. And one of the questions that's out there on the table is where, if at all, bevacizumab should be included in the ovarian cancer spectrum, so to speak. And, you know, for example, if you were to see this patient again, you know, at point A, 2003, mm-hmm. she has an optimally debulked surgery. Would you have used it there? Would you use it when she presented with recurrence disease? Right now, how do you think through bevacizumab outside a study?
So it's quite interesting. There are sort of two or three major studies that are sort of informing where we're going with bevacizumab. So last year, I think we saw the findings of GOG-218. And this year at ASCO, ICON 7 updated their results. And Ocean's trial also presented their results. And so what's emerging is that certainly there is benefit to giving bevacizumab in conjunction with chemotherapy and then continuing into a maintenance setting with first-line therapy. Both GOG-218 and ICON 7 show that. From the ICON 7 updated results, it looks as if the results seem to be better for patients who have more disease at presentation, so the patients in the higher risk category of ICON 7, which more closely matches with the GOG-218 population. So the patients who have either suboptimal debulked disease or macroscopic residual disease seem to be the ones who seem to derive greater benefit, certainly in terms of progression-free survival at the moment. And the trend from ASCO that was reported shows that there is a trend in terms of overall survival as well.
You were a central figure in the ICON effort looking at bevacizumab. Where do things stand right now in terms of publication?
The manuscript is currently being reviewed. The ICON 7 data are becoming mature. There's still a overall survival endpoint that is being actively followed for, and that won't be mature until 2013. So we won't know the final OS data for another year or two.
One of the issues with ICON is they use a different dose
right.
than the GOG. Can you go through that? I'm just kind of curious in terms of bevacizumab issues like hypertension. Indirectly, do you think there's any difference?
Right. So the ICON 7 dose that was used was 7.5 milligrams per kilogram as opposed to the GOG-218 dose of 15 milligrams per kilogram. And the reasons for choosing a lower dose were, to a certain extent, that was the dose that was approved for colorectal cancer at the time. We also were developing both studies more or less in parallel. So it was felt that this would be sort of informative, both in terms of activity and also safety profile. And when you actually look at the toxicity profiles of GOG-218 and ICON 7, in fact, both of the experimental arms with the bevacizumab seemed to be relatively well tolerated. There weren't any real safety concerns of incorporating bevacizumab at either 7.5 or at 15 milligrams that really stood out. There are a number of increased adverse events that are seen related to bevacizumab that are class effects, like hypertension, minor mucocutaneous bleeding, you know, bleeding gums or occasional nosebleeds. But major toxicities that we were really worried about, such as bowel perforation or major hemorrhage or clotting, they were seemed to be sort of relatively uncommon in both of the experimental arms of both studies. Now, we tried to do at the IGCS meeting last year, Bob Berger and I did a comparison of the two studies side by side to really look at whether the toxicity profile stood out in one study compared to the other because of the dose. And it's pretty hard to show that, to be honest. There doesn't seem to be a significant adverse risk by giving the 15 milligrams as opposed to 7.5 milligrams. So in terms of safety, I think both doses are safe. However, what we did also drill down on is whether there is any improvement in terms of activity by giving double the dose. And to be honest, if you compare like with like in terms of the suboptimal population from ICON 7 and compare that with the GOG-218, the magnitude of benefit is essentially very, very similar between the two studies. So I think that if I was trying to choose a dose and a schedule, I would actually choose 7.5 milligrams, and I would actually give it for longer if I could, rather than the duration that was specified in the study.
Longer, you know, one issue would be, I guess, the cost would be less if you have a lower dose.
Right. So the cost should be less, depending upon how the drug is priced, but the cost should be less by giving it at 7.5 milligrams. And certainly that seems to be true right now. But I think that, again, the reason for considering giving it longer is that the maximum benefit that we saw with ICON 7 occurred at 12 months, which is around the time that bevacizumab was discontinued. And as soon as the bevacizumab was discontinued, you can see that the level of benefit in terms of progression-free survival starts tapering off. And that's been reported as sort of non-proportional hazards, that there's a peaking of benefit at 12 months and then the benefit tapers off. And that does suggest that giving it for longer would perhaps be more advantageous. And that, in a first-line setting, is being tested out in a randomized clinical trial being done by the German group, the AGO group. They're looking at comparing giving bevacizumab for 15 months versus continuing till progression. The OCEANS study that was reported at ASCO this year in a platinum-sensitive recurrent population, in fact, built in concurrent chemotherapy with bevacizumab. They used carboplatin and gemcitabine as a backbone, and then the randomization was plus or minus bevacizumab given at the time of chemotherapy and then continued until progression. So this actually did give bevacizumab until progression as a maintenance, and they showed a very significant separation of the curves starting out immediately after commencing therapy and continuing for a long time. So the hazard ratio on that study was about 0.48, which was highly statistically significant. And I think that the fact that the bevacizumab was continued until progression probably maintained that control of disease for a longer period of time.
And this question of duration of bevacizumab came up initially with the adjuvant colon study that the NSABP reported at one point. So when you say that you'd like to use it longer, does that mean until progression?
Yeah, I think that ideally I'd like to use it until progression. Now, certainly that builds in a very significant cost element. And so I think we need to be better at defining which populations we would want to consider that for. And what seems to be emerging is that the patients who are at highest risk, patients who either have bulkier disease or are suboptimal debulk at onset or at recurrence have platinum-sensitive recurrence and have disease that's apparent in those patients who are at high risk of having recurrent disease over a short period of time, continuing till progression would make a lot more sense. Patients who have very early stage disease, so for example, stage 1, stage 2, completely optimally debulked disease, for those patients where there is a reasonable good prognosis anyway with standard therapies, bevacizumab until progression probably doesn't make any type of viable sense.
You mentioned that there are other anti-angiogenic strategies being used in ovarian cancer and sort of the biology of the disease. You were an author on a paper presented last year at ASCO. Beth Carlin was the first author on an agent called AMG-386. I don't know if it's got a name yet, but can you explain how this agent actually works and what's been seen?
Right. So the study that we were doing was looking at AMG-386 in a randomized setting. It was a randomized phase 2 study with weekly paclitaxel. It was a 3-arm study, and I'll describe that in a second. AMG-386 is one of the newer generation of anti-angiogenics, which is looking at Tie-1, Tie-2 blockade. And it's a completely different mechanism of action in terms of the anti-angiogenic stimulus compared to VEGF inhibitors. And because it acts at a completely different receptor and different point, the activity is felt not to be directly sort of influenced by prior use of VEGF inhibitors as well, quite likely. It also raises the possibility that in the future, you might be able to look at angiogenesis and look at it biologically at attacking it at 2 or 3 different points. So you might be able to combine an anti-VEGF agent like bevacizumab with AMG-386-like agent, which is looking at tie receptor inhibition. The study that we presented looked at giving weekly paclitaxel in a randomized setting. Patients had different dose levels of AMG-386, and there was one placebo control as well. So there was one group of patients who had just paclitaxel weekly by itself, and the other two arms had AMG-386 that was added to it. And the study showed that there was a significant improvement in terms of the progression-free survival of patients who had recurrent platinum-resistant disease who were treated with weekly paclitaxel plus AMG-386. There seemed to be a slight dose effect, which is being further explored, but both of the arms seemed to do much better than the control arm of weekly paclitaxel. And interestingly, there was activity with weekly paclitaxel as well. So that study has in fact led to a sort of randomized phase 3 study, which is being done with potential registration intent, which is a randomization between weekly paclitaxel plus either placebo or AMG-386. It's a study that is in platinum-resistant disease, and patients are being followed for PFS as well as an overall survival endpoint. That study started about 6 months ago and is accruing quite well internationally.
Now, this is an oral or intravenous agent?
It's an intravenous agent.
And what kind of side effects profile?
So it's quite interesting. It's a very different side effect profile. It doesn't have the classical side effects such as hypertension that are seen. All of the patients are being followed with the view to those anti-angiogenic type of side effects like hypertension and potential for bleeding, potential for blood clots. We have seen some patients who have developed peripheral edema, very gradual peripheral edema that develops over a long period of time. This is a relatively low frequency event, but it's interesting that it may perhaps be affecting lymphangiogenesis as well. And so perhaps it may be reshaping sort of lymphatic vessels, which may lead to generally a mild peripheral edema picture. It doesn't seem to be a fluid retention type of peripheral edema. It comes on, it stays, and it doesn't go away immediately on discontinuing the agent either. So that's one of the sort of unique side effects that's been seen on the previous study.
That's really interesting. You see it in the feet?
Yeah, I've seen it in a couple of my patients in the legs, but it can be other limbs as well. It could be arms. And it's a sort of fairly uncommon side effect, but it comes on very, very gradually when it does come on. I think that one of the recent events that, again, in the studies we're looking at is whether there is a picture of some transient causation of fluid like ascites in some patients. Whether that's related to the drug or not is unclear at the moment. But by and large, the drug profile, the safety profile, is actually quite encouraging. It's actually well tolerated. It can be continued and sustained for a long period of time. It doesn't seem to cause major problems related to hypertension. So it's actually been a relatively easy agent to use other than being intravenous.
Any thoughts about combining it with bevacizumab?
Yep. In fact, those trials are going on. And that's exactly the direction that I think we need to move in, which is to see if a synergistic approach looking at combining bevacizumab with AMG-386 would work. It'll be very interesting to see what those trials are, particularly in ovarian cancer, as to whether this combination strategy will give good activity just with the targeted agents themselves.
Be interesting to see the tolerability, although I guess you'd expect it should be fine.
That's right, it should be, because I think that you're attacking different anti-angiogenic pathways. It should be reasonably well tolerated in combination, unless there's some other vascular complication that we haven't seen before by blocking either pathway on its own.
So another subject that comes up when people talk about anti-angiogenesis are multikinase or VEGF TKIs. Sorafenib, I saw you had a paper looking at that. Sunitinib, and a new generation. I think there's another one, BIBF-1120. Any of these showing promise?
Yeah, a lot of these are showing promise. And in fact, looking at the spectrum of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, many of them seem to have, you know, reasonably good activity when you try and define it in phase 2 studies in ovarian cancer. And several of these are in randomized phase 2 and even in phase 3 settings. So pazopanib has been used as a sort of maintenance strategy after completion of primary chemotherapy in ovarian cancer. Sorafenib has been used in a randomized phase 2 in patients who have a complete response to chemotherapy, again, to try and maintain that response with an anti-angiogenic agent. And some of the newer ones like BIBF, which showed promise in phase 2 setting, are going through randomized phase 3 clinical trials in a frontline setting in conjunction with standard chemotherapy in ovarian cancer. So many of these are showing, you know, really quite interesting activity. And certainly the ability to take these agents orally is much easier for the patient, so that you can take an oral therapy, which if it was continued into maintenance setting, would be much easier than having to come into a hospital every 3 or 4 weeks. On the other hand, the toxicity profile is also different with these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I mean, certainly the data to date would suggest that there is perhaps a higher association with hypertension. There is a higher association with metabolic syndromes that are seen less commonly. but you'll often see a spectrum of thyroid function abnormalities, as well as abnormalities of electrolytes in some patients, magnesium and phosphate imbalance, and sometimes also changes which cause hyponatremia. And many of the patients will also feel a little bit chronically unwell, particularly when these agents are started. That seems to improve over time. But despite the fact that they're oral, the side effect profile has not been as easy as we initially thought that they were going to be. And we're certainly having to pay a lot more careful attention to monitoring those patients, looking after hypertension, perhaps doing dose adjustments, and also keeping an eye on a range of other blood tests which can suddenly become awry, like thyroid function or metabolic function. And that creates a bit of a challenge in terms of routine use of these agents.
Anything specific about the BIBF compound in terms of how it works or its tolerability profile, or is it just another one of the multi-kinase and who knows exactly what it's hitting?
Right. I mean, there's a fair amount known about it, but there isn't any information at this point that allows us to discriminate its activity compared to the other agents that are there. I think that it's a fairly broad spectrum multi-kinase inhibitor, but I think it has activity against the FGF pathway as well. But in terms of whether this will translate into a better level of activity in ovarian cancer is hard to say at this point.
Let's talk about your 55-year-old woman.
So this patient is someone who I'm still following. It's a woman who was referred to me a couple of years ago. She was initially diagnosed with BRCA1 positive ovarian cancer. She had a strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer in her family. And she was diagnosed in 2006 with ovarian cancer, having presented with abdominal distension. And she underwent a TAH-BSO. And unfortunately, her disease was suboptimally debulked at the outset. She had high-grade serous histology, which would be the sort of common finding with BRCA-positive disease. And she was staged as 3C. And she did well with standard chemotherapy. At the time that she was treated with paclitaxel and carboplatin. And she did very well. She had 6 cycles of therapy and remained sort of disease-free for almost 2 years. And in 2008, she sort of had recurrent disease again. And she was being treated in Britain at this time, in fact, with paclitaxel and carboplatin, and had 6 cycles with a partial response. In 2009, maybe about a year or so after her last cycle of chemotherapy, she had recurrent disease, and because of the sort of interval between her last treatment and recurrent disease, she was still deemed to be platinum sensitive. And she was referred to me at that time for consideration of clinical trials. And we had a sort of interesting option. On the one hand, the standard therapy would dictate that because of a platinum sensitive disease, she would be eligible to have combination chemotherapy with a platinum-based regimen. And the options we discussed were carboplatin and liposomal doxorubicin or carboplatin paclitaxel again. We had a clinical trial, sort of single agent phase 2 Canadian study that we were doing, which was looking at olaparib, one of the PARP inhibitors. And we were looking at women who either had declared BRCA mutations, or there was a cohort of women who had unknown BRCA status but high grade serous histology. And so we offered her the choice of participating in that trial, and the preliminary data from the phase ones to that point had been encouraging. So she, in fact, decided that she would very much like to participate in the clinical trial and went on to start. At the time, she had a small volume peritoneal disease, and she had a CA125, which was significantly elevated at over 1,000. She had no disease in the lungs, but she had sort of fairly widespread peritoneal metastatic disease. And within a 6 to 8 week period, she started showing signs of response, both in terms of CA125 going down. She felt quite well throughout. And her objective imaging showed regression of her disease. She's now been on this same regimen for just shy of 2 years. She's been continuing on the olaparib, and in fact has been doing extremely well. Her CA125 has remained controlled, and her CT scan show no evidence of disease. And she's tolerating it very well, and she's clinically asymptomatic. We're sort of continuing with it until there is any evidence of progression.
So I'm really glad you picked this patient, because that study that you were a part of was my favorite presentation of the 2010 ASCO meeting, all tumor types. I love that. It was Karen Gelman presented that.
That's
so
right.
This is a patient who was on that study.
Yep, absolutely. And she's still on that study.
Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that data set. You also looked at breast cancer as part of that, but maybe you can talk about, you know, what was seen there.
So the study had four different cohorts that we built in. We looked at two control cohorts within the study, and the control cohorts were patients who had declared BRCA mutations, who had either breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And then the experimental cohorts that we really wanted to measure against the controls were essentially looking at women who had high-grade serous ovarian cancer or with BRCA status that was unknown or negative, or women who had triple-negative breast cancer, and again, BRCA status unknown or negative. And this was a slightly complex study where we did ask all of the patients to consent to tumor biopsies as well prior to treatment starting and also at about the two-month mark. And there was a sort of two-stage process that was built into the two experimental cohorts so that if there was evidence of response that was seen in the first 15 patients, then the cohorts would be expanded. And what we found was that looking at the breast cancer cohort, we did not see a significant amount of activity in the triple negative BRCA unknown patient population. And so that cohort was not expanded, it was closed. The ovarian cancer cohort, we did see that there was a significant single agent activity being seen. And so that cohort was expanded from 15 patients initially to a total of almost 55 patients. All of the patients who participated in the BRCA unknown ovarian cohort or negative cohort were all sort of, again, counseled and tested for BRCA status as well, so that anybody who had BRCA mutations could then be put into a BRCA control, and we could then truly evaluate the level of activity of olaparib in women who had BRCA negative high-grade serous ovarian cancer. And in that patient population, we found that there was significant single-agent activity. The level of activity seemed to correspond with platinum sensitivity or platinum resistance. It was certainly much higher in platinum-sensitive women with ovarian cancer. But there was some activity that was seen in platinum-resistant disease as well. We also looked at CA125 responses as well as objective RECIST responses. And the total level of activity that was seen seemed to suggest that in platinum-sensitive disease, the response rates are in the region of about 40 to 50%. In platinum-resistant disease, the RECIST response rate was about 5% or so, but CA125 responses were seen in about 25 to 30% of women. The study is still going to go through some biologic assessments of the tumor tissue to really see if we can try and get biomarker information in terms of, you know, what constitutes likelihood of response with these patients. Can we identify a signature that would allow us to better select patients for treatment other than just high-grade serous histology? Based on the sort of recent data that's coming from the Genome Atlas Mapping Project, where ovarian cancer patients have been sort of completely genotyped, it does suggest that homologous recombination defects are seen in almost about 50% of women with high-grade serous ovarian cancer. And this would be the potential pool of patients who would be most likely to respond to PARP inhibitors. So I think that we're getting better at identifying subpopulations that are likely to respond to PARP inhibitors, but we don't have a specific signature at the moment, and that's where we need to do some more work.
So getting back to this patient, then, she had tissue accessed also for this study, and where was it from?
So she had a peritoneal nodule that was biopsied at the time of study entry, and interestingly, the study called for a repeat biopsy about 2 months later. And at that time, she had such a significant response that we couldn't biopsy her disease again. The radiologist felt that that would be unsafe to do so. And she's still continuing on therapy. She's now almost 2 years out.
I remember there was somebody who stood up right after that presentation and said, "How do I get this drug? I've got three patients in my practice right now that I, you know, would like to try it on. Is this an agent that you would like to have available, or do you think is, you know, obviously it's not approved, but, or is it too early to say that?"
Well, I would love to have this agent as part of the armamentum in terms of treating ovarian cancer. And I think that what we really need is urgent registration strategy. I think that there is a little bit of frustration in the field because the first study that identified activity of olaparib and PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer, BRCA-positive ovarian cancer, was almost 5 years ago now. And there's been a sort of long delay in terms of getting this agent to patients. Now, there have been a lot of studies that have been done in this setting. And this year at ASCO, Jonathan Lederman presented a really powerful study which showed that patients who had platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, who had been treated with chemotherapy and were subsequently randomized to maintenance, olaparib versus placebo, had an excellent improvement in progression-free survival. The hazard ratio was something like 0.35.
And again, these were not BRCA patients.
These were not BRCA patients. These were patients with high-grade serous ovarian cancer. In fact, we participated in that study as well. And so in a maintenance setting, it does suggest that olaparib does seem to have a sort of major role to play in maintaining response. So I think that one of the challenges has been in terms of trying to segregate the activity of PARP inhibitors from the activity that would be seen in patients with platinum-sensitive disease with platinum or in other patients with liposomal doxorubicin. So I think there's been a bit of dilemma in terms of how to show differential activity of the PARP inhibitors in a randomized setting over and above standard therapy. And secondly, trying to factor in quality of life and patient convenience into the equation. I mean, certainly from the patients that we've treated, the activity has been very, very encouraging. And I think most of the patients we've treated would prefer to take olaparib orally compared to receiving intravenous chemotherapy. So how best do we use it? And certainly the early signs are suggesting giving it either concurrent or post-chemotherapy and maintaining the response may be a really excellent way of using these agents.
So why don't we briefly talk about the other patient, because I think it brings up a specific point in a paper that you wrote that I wanted to ask you about. This is your 45-year-old lady.
Sure. So the patient was a young woman who presented with abdominal distension and an axial mass, and she had sort of fairly widespread peritoneal disease that was seen on imaging. She had an elevated CA125. The picture was sort of classical for ovarian cancer. And because she had very widespread disease, the gynecologist did a core biopsy, confirmed the diagnosis of ovarian cancer, and in fact elected to treat the patient with neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And we can talk about that in a minute. The patient had paclitaxel and carboplatin and had an excellent response very quickly after starting chemotherapy. Within a cycle, she was feeling better. Her ascites was drying up. And by the time that she had three cycles of therapy, she had a sort of fairly dramatic clinical response to therapy. And after three cycles of chemotherapy, she underwent elective interval debulking, which was TAH, BSO, and omentectomy. And she was optimally debulked, completely clear of disease at the end of debulking surgery. And post-surgery, there was a sort of interesting clinical trial that we're participating in, which is OV21. It's led by the National Cancer Institute of Canada, NCIC Clinical Trials Group. And it's being conducted in Canada, US, UK, and Spain. And this trial is essentially looking at the role of intraperitoneal chemotherapy following interval debulking and whether it still has a role following interval debulking. And so the patient elected to participate in the clinical trial. The trial has two stages to it. The first stage of the trial is a randomized study, which is looking at comparing standard IV carboplatin and paclitaxel versus another arm, which is comparing intraperitoneal carboplatin and paclitaxel. And the third arm is looking at intraperitoneal cisplatin and paclitaxel. And the trial is matched so that the paclitaxel in all three arms is given on a day one, day eight schedule to sort of essentially try and minimize any differences between the scheduling of the IV and the IP. And so the patient elected to participate in the clinical trial, and she's been randomized to intraperitoneal carboplatin paclitaxel arm. And the treatment is still ongoing. So the whole concept of this trial was to sort of really address a number of questions. One is, with the increasing use of neoadjuvant chemotherapy and interval debulking, is there still a role for intraperitoneal chemotherapy following interval debulking? And secondly, we're also trying to sort of look from a toxicity and efficacy point of view whether intraperitoneal carboplatin is as efficacious as intraperitoneal cisplatin, and certainly look at the toxicity comparison between the two.
So, yeah, you have this paper that just came out, Current Oncology, talking about this study. And one of the things that struck me, as opposed to the intraperitoneal study the GOG is doing, is I don't see bevacizumab here.
Right. So this study was sort of designed before the ICON 7 results and before the GOG 218 results came in. And so there's been a lot of discussion about whether this study should continue as is and how do we factor in bevacizumab. So at the moment, the study is sort of looking at it purely from an intraperitoneal chemotherapy point of view, and the patient population post-interval debulking surgery would be an optimally debulked patient population, so not exactly similar to GOG 218 population. So the GOG study elected to look at the addition of bevacizumab. This study doesn't have that option at the moment, and so it is going to be a question as to patients, which direction should they go in? Because the patient population is a sort of slightly better patient population that is optimally debulked, I think the study PIs and sponsors are still comfortable with keeping it as a pure study without bevacizumab.
If I understand correctly, the GOG study, all the arms get bev, is that right?
That's right. And I think that that was sort of a decision that was made early on based on, you know, if bevacizumab is improving outcome, then how do you sort of take it to the next level? So I think the GOG study is looking at incorporating bevacizumab. So I think that these will be sort of complementary studies when they're completed.